You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
As a startup founder, you're juggling multiple priorities, from the expected, like finding product market fit, to the unexpected, like customer requests for SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification.
But achieving compliance is time consuming, and time spent on it is time away from the needs of the business.
That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one solution for startups to become compliant quickly and build a security foundation with ease.
With a combination of automation, an extensive partner network, and a security marketplace, Vanta provides the necessary tools and expertise for startups to achieve compliance seamlessly, no matter how urgent the needs are and at every phase of growth.
Over 10,000 leading companies, including CipherStash, Handle, and Indebted, trust Vanta to automate compliance so they can focus on growing their business.
Startup customers get 10% off Vanta at dayone.fm/Vanta/first check, or just go to the link in the show notes.
Hey, Maxine, quick question. Do you like birds? And what about cyber? Do you struggle with that?
Birds, yes. Cyber, well, it's complicated. But lucky for us, that's where Galahr Cyber swoops in.
Galahr Cyber is perfect whether you're a founder looking for practical security advice or an investor needing solid risk management for your portcos.
So if you want to secure your business and join a flock that is unlike most security firms, head over to dayone.fm/Galahr for your free conversation with Cole, who can set you off in the right direction.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, I'm Cheryl.
I'm Maxine.
This is First Check, part of Day One, the network dedicated to founders, operators, and investors.
If you want to be a better early stage investor, this is the show for you.
So TLDR, if you don't want to suck at investing, listen up.
All right, so this next episode, I am super pumped for. This one is for all of you emerging fund managers, first-time fund managers, and thinking about raising a fund.
Yeah, soon-to-be fund managers, whether that's this year, next year, the year after, in 10 years' time. I think this is a really helpful background, but also for entrepreneurs, you know, people who are working with fund managers as their key stakeholders, as investors, understanding their incentives, understanding the environment they're operating in so that you can understand how that might impact their ability to invest in your company to start off with, to follow on if they're already investors, or you know, why it's really hard to get them to respond to a call in certain times of the year.
Yes, 100%. And I think this is a good time of year to be publishing this one. Start of the year, sentiments rebuilding.
Yeah, new year, new you, and or new fund.
Excellent. Let's jump into it. So actually, we haven't even told people the topic. We just, you know, said who it's for. Yeah, let's get right in.
Just get right in. Just dive right in. You can guess what the topic is based on what we start to talk about. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, so topic is fund cycles. What are they? What do you need to know about how the cycle of a fund works? When do you raise? When do you close? You know, lifespan, everything. We're kind of giving this like broad headline topic of fund cycles. But if anyone can come up with a more interesting title for this after you listen to it, please send us an email.
We promise to edit all of the headlines across all of our socials and the links to them. But yeah, so overarching, as you said, talking about the mechanics, the meat and potatoes of raising funds, deploying funds, raising your next fund, and thinking about how you structure those.
You know why I think this is really interesting? And one of the things that I was listening to something else and was like, hey, I think we need to talk about this, is because we see these headlines sometimes where it's like, you know, fund XYZ is raising this much to deploy into this category. And until I understood fund cycles, to me, I read that as in like, okay, cool, they've got that amount of money, they've raised it, and now they're going to start deploying. But often that initial article that goes out in the AFR or, you know, Startup Daily or whatever it is, that article is usually the like kickoff of them saying, hey, we're going to start to raise. And that to me isn't intuitive.
No, totally. And I think also what isn't clear is sometimes there is those kickoffs and then they fail to raise. We saw a lot of this in 22 and 23, less in 24, but also some of that. And people kind of announced that they would be raising funds. And then the funding market was really, really tough and they couldn't get them away. And so they weren't actually in market. So as entrepreneurs, using those announcements as an indicator that you're deploying capital or that a fund is deploying capital can be indicative, but it isn't necessarily that they are out deploying. Yeah. So maybe that's a good kickoff. How do you start the process of raising a fund?
There's this interesting concept in Australia where you kind of have to choose between raising what we call an ESVCLP, which is an early stage limited venture capital fund, partnership. I almost got there. I almost got all the letters.
ESVCLF? Question mark.
I almost got all the letters. Come back to me on that one. But that is a much more in-depth process, but comes along with some tax benefits. And I think we did do a whole episode on that.
We sure did.
So if you want to learn more about that, jump into that episode. But as a fund manager in Australia, you do need to kind of make that choice, first of all. And I don't think we'll go too much into it, but that's like a first one to think of is like, well, do I want to do this like more tax beneficial one, but has a lot more admin requirements? Or can I start small and build up a really good quality fund without necessarily taking advantage of those tax benefits? But it is a lot easier to get started and get deploying and therefore get into market and therefore potentially earn returns.
Absolutely. And just as a cliff notes, if you don't want to listen to a whole nother episode on tax, the main tax benefit is that returns via your fund to your LPs are tax-free. There's some qualifications and stuff there, but consider it as a, well, actually it comes in as your, as income, right? It's tax beneficial and you also get a tax credit.
So as a fund manager, it comes under capital account up until a certain amount. And then as an LP, it comes under like it's tax-free.
Yeah, that's right. Excellent. Love the expert in the room.
Yeah.
When you are thinking about kicking off, as you said, there's that consideration of, do I go ahead and register as an ESVCLP and get these benefits for my LPs and myself? Or do I kick off something smaller? I think a material thing that I would name here is I'm seeing a lot more micro VCs step into the ecosystem. So sub 10 million. So for an ESVCLP, you need to be raising $10 million or more. And so if you're raising less than that, then the decision is made for you. You won't be eligible for an ESVCLP. But you can actually start deploying once you're conditionally approved as a ESVCLP if you haven't raised the entire thing, but you have to be pretty sure you're going to get to that 10 million. Otherwise, LPs will invest expecting tax benefits and they will not accrue to them. So it will be a pretty uncomfortable conversation.
It's also interesting that the conditional and unconditional status of getting the ESVCLP as a fund, they give you 2 years to do that. So there is an underlying assumption there that it could take you 2 years to raise a fund. What are you seeing in market? Like, I've seen some funds who told me they were raising 10 years ago and are still raising said fund.
The US, at least from the data that I've seen, top quartile is 4 months. So from initial raise, and that's in the US ecosystem. So the US ecosystem has a similar process. They measure from first close, so first money in your first close, to final close, last money in your final close. And that's 4 months, which is like outrageously fast.
Oh, interesting though. I'm thinking about like anecdotally, the funds I've heard who have said, hey, we're raising until final close, not from first close. I'm thinking like the first time I heard them say, hey, we're raising, here's my IM.
I don't, obviously, I mean, I only have anecdotal data on those ones as well. I would say like April Underwood did it in 12 in the US, I think, for Adverb Ventures. I'm sure there are others that have raised much faster than that.
Somewhere between 12 to 24 months is kind of my guesstimate there.
12 months is in the middle of the bell curve. In the US, you have to raise in 18 months. So it's a pretty precipitous drop off.
What happens if you don't raise?
Just you don't get the necessary confirmation, like SEC confirmation. So once you start raising, kind of you have to close within 18 months. And so you just close at whatever price you've got.
But their version of once you start is first close, right? Not once you say.
First money in your first close. So if you do like a rolling first close, let's say it takes you 3 weeks to finalize checks, it's when the first dollars hit your bank account, I believe, is when the timer starts, which can catch some people. Whereas in Australia, we don't have that. As you said there, you can be raising.
It's just when you're conditionally registered if you're doing an ESVCLP.
Right. Or if you're not doing an ESVCLP, if you're using a kind of traditional trust structure, you can just keep going.
Yeah, which is really interesting.
So yeah, between 12 and 18 months is the usual that I've seen.
Which kind of begs the question around like, well, if you want to start deploying in 6 months, then is it realistic to be able to raise that fund in that time? Probably not, right? And then also if you're thinking about doing a second fund and your timeline around, usually like from what I've seen, usually funds will be deploying the capital. So once they've done that second close, they'll deploy the capital within 2 to 3 years from that time, right?
Correct. Yeah. So fund deployment periods, you usually have to commit to in your fund docs. And there is some flexibility there. They're not, you know, hard and fast, but it's not like will deploy in two and you deploy in four. And the reason for that is a big part of funds management and investing in this asset class is vintages. And we've talked a little bit about that on this podcast. And so if I'm investing in a 2023 vintage fund and I'm expecting that fund to be a collection of investments over the years 23, 24, and 25, if I then bundle into that 26, 27, 28, that's not really the diversification I was hoping for. Or alternatively, if you say to me you're investing in 22, 23, and 24, then you deploy all of your capital in 2022, also not really the thing I was investing in.
Also not what I was aiming for.
There's some flexibility on the edges, but not a material amount. So anywhere between kind of 2 to 4 years is the deployment cycle that you've seen. I would say in this current market, I'm seeing lots more fours than I'm seeing twos. Twos was a very kind of 2021, 2022 era thing to do.
Lots of good deals. Deploy, deploy, deploy.
Deploy, deploy, deploy. Oh, turns out they weren't such good deals. But 23 and 24, I'm seeing people extend out those deployment periods. And this is all subject to negotiation, right? You can start deploying on a 2-year fund cycle and then determine, hey, that's not going to be the right thing for me. And if you can renegotiate those terms with your LPs and your, you know, the folks that invested in your fund, then you can extend it out to 3 or to 4, or you can build that flexibility into your deal documents.
First comment, I love that we have adopted wine terminology on fund cycles in general. Just vintages is fantastic. I have actually gotten a few like wines from funds that I've invested in with the year on them, which is kind of cool.
Oh, that's cute. I like that.
Second comment, or is more of a question. You say this is negotiation, but like, let's say you've got 50 LPs in your fund. Are you going to go back to all of them and be like, hey, actually, this isn't working. I want to deploy over 3 years instead of 2, do you get them all to like sign a yes, you're good? Or like, is it just conversation? Like, what does that actually look like?
That's a great question. I've actually never seen the meat and potatoes of how you actually deliver that. I know anecdotally, folks just negotiate it with their major LPs, and there's sometimes a defined term major LPs in their LPAs or in their issue documents in Australia. Sometimes it kind of depends on how many LPs you're working with as well, right? Like if you're working with 50 LPs, and you're planning on changing it from a 2 to a 4, I would argue that that's a fairly material change and would imagine that you need to get kind of re-executed documents from everyone.
Buy-in from everyone, yeah.
Where if we're talking about, you know, 3 to 3.2, it's probably not something that's material enough for you to need a documentary change, but it is still worthwhile having a conversation with LPs.
Or at least an email heads up.
Yeah.
And an explanation.
I mean, at the very minimum, If you can't have a verbal conversation with your LPs about a topic like this, the only way to get in front of them is an email, then I'd seriously consider deepening that relationship or finding new LPs for fund two.
That, or like, I do know a few funds that have 100 plus LPs and many of them are small checks, and it's probably just not like, you just don't have the time to give every single one a call.
Yeah.
So I could see like, you know, the bottom 20 of them just getting an email. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I have not personally gotten that email, though I will say anecdotally, a lot of the funds that I'm invested in are deploying very slowly to the point where like my capital calls are like 5%. And I'm like, perfect. Yes, let me send you in the thousands.
Oh dear. So I think, I mean, that's a really important point as you're thinking about, for those folks who are thinking about raising a fund, either fund one or fund two, is having a serious think about what is the deployment pace that you want to meet. When you are raising faster, i.e. you're doing 2-year deployments and you're raising every 2 years, there's not a lot of break between fundraisers, depending on how long it takes you to raise a fund.
That's what I was getting at, is like, well, if I do the math on like, all right, it takes 18 months to raise a fund, you deploy in say 2 to 3 years. And then this kind of brings us back to this concept of like, don't run out of money as an investor, fund manager.
Super important.
Don't run out of money. So like, you kind of have to start raising the next fund when you close the first one.
Which is a tough thing to pull off, right? I would venture a guess that anecdotally, the number of fund managers who are deploying out of 2-year funds also correlate to the number of fund managers who are raising funds in sub 6 months, right? They strike me as like fast raise, fast deployment strategy. So you might be doing smaller funds, for example, or you're Naval.
Or you're just that person.
You're just a boss.
Yeah.
And so you have you know, pretty limitless access to capital and can pretty quickly raise and then be deploying behind that strategy. Whereas, you know, if it's taking you 18 months to raise, then you probably are not in a position to be doing two-year deployment periods because you'll likely be having conversations with LPs ahead of a new fund pretty much while you're still closing those same LPs on fund one, which is a pretty tough conversation to pull off.
Yeah, it's a bit awkward. Like, hey, great, you just invested in this one. I've made zero investments. You good to go into fund two?
Right, right, exactly.
Oh, and the NAV is negative because we took out management fees.
Oh, yeah, by the way, did I mention that you've gone backwards before you went forwards?
Want to give me more money?
Exactly. Tough conversation to land, as you can probably imagine. So most funds, and especially in this market, most funds are doing 3 to 4. So they're raising for, you know, 12 to 18.
3 to 4 years deployment period, and then raising every like two years?
Pretty much, yeah. So the rule of thumb is you start raising the next fund when you are roughly 75% deployed.
Ah, look at that rule of thumb.
Rule of thumb. So some people do it earlier, right? If it's been tougher for them to raise. So in this market, you would expect more people are doing it slightly earlier. Maybe they're 2/3 of the way through their fund. So 66% of the way through their fund. It's tough to do it any earlier than that because once you start having those conversations, it's similar to a founder, right? Having conversations about fundraising means you're fundraising. And so, you know, once the momentum kicks off and you really want to foster that momentum in your raise, that you need to be ready to kind of run at it. So you need materials and data rooms and all of those kind of things.
Just like a startup.
If you're raising fund two, you want some pretty juicy NAV numbers. You ideally, you're anywhere between kind of 1.8 to 2x NAV by the time you're raising your next fund. If you're raising from institutionals, they generally look at 3 funds ago. So you can imagine if you are an emerging fund manager.
Hey, I'm first fund.
Yeah, fund one minus 3 equals no funds for them to look at. So you're not raising from them. But if you are raising from family offices or those folks, they can sometimes be comfortable, or the bigger institutional family offices, they'll sometimes be comfortable to look at kind of fund one and fund two. And that's the point at which you start talking about to those institutions.
So what about this concept of, like, I think angels get told this concept of don't run out of money a lot. And we talk about that as angel investors, like don't run out of money. How does that apply for fund managers? Like, that's still a really important concept, right? Like, you don't want to run out of money as a fund manager because it still means you can't deploy. But yeah, what are your thoughts on how that applies to fund managers?
I mean, I think the best analogy that I can think of when people talk about this in fund management is imagine a scenario where you are a business owner and you have nothing to sell. Like, you're a supermarket, you just got no food to sell. Like, what do you think is going to happen? People are going to not come to your supermarket anymore, right? They're not going to come to you to purchase the product. So depending on how long you are in market for without anything to sell, it becomes kind of performative for you to meet founders. Now, sometimes fund managers will still take those meetings. If we're talking about a month or two that's kind of bridging that period, I think that that's reasonable. But there's a point beyond which it starts to become, you know, slightly disingenuous that you're meeting founders that you're actually not able to invest in. You're wasting their time, you're wasting your time. And so you need to make sure that as a fund manager, you always have enough capital. There's also a fund construction reality, right? We keep beating that drum on this podcast of the importance of the power law. I actually don't know the month of the year that Canva raised their first round. Let's say it was somewhere between July and October of that year. If you just happened to have no money in that period of time,
and you saw them, you could have invested,
and you didn't invest. Like, that is a sucky way to miss one of the best success stories out of the Australian ecosystem. So there is a reality that, you know, you have to have that surface area with luck by having deployable capital so that you can deploy when you meet really interesting companies. Also, from a fund perspective, you don't want to have a situation where, let's say you're investing over a 3-year period, you run out of money at, you know, 2.5, and you're just not deploying for that second half, because then again, your LPs are not getting the diversification, the time-based diversification that they are paying for.
That they thought they were getting. It's kind of like your supermarket's empty, but you're on the street corner still asking people to come in.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. You're still like hawking on the street corner being like, step right up, tomatoes on special.
with the flippy sign, you know, you're out there like spinning a sign.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it just is a bad dynamic for everyone.
Good analogy. I like that.
If you're raising fund one, This is obviously not something you have to be thinking about. If you're an angel investor, it's something to think about, right? To make sure that you don't run out of money. But if you're raising fund two or you're planning to raise fund two, then it's something really to think about, especially as you are kicking off fund one and ideally are going to raise fund two in a couple of years. Deployment pace really matters. Check size really matters. The right math around reserves really matters, so that you don't run out of dry powder before you get to that, like in range for that deployment period.
Next fund.
Yeah, for that next fund, and then get stuck in a situation where you need to raise capital early or not be able to raise because you need to give some time for your NAV to grow sufficiently that you're an interesting fund to invest in for fund two or fund three. And then you are, you need to make sure, you know, you're really in a tough spot.
It makes me nervous, honestly, when I think about stuff like that, because I'm like, this is the scary things about raising a fund. And this is why I don't want to do it until I'm like absolutely certain. Because the other thing is like, this is a 10-year thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So each time you commit to raising a new fund, you're committing to another 10 years of doing this.
Yeah, to 12.
Yeah.
Most of them have 2-year extensions. So 12-year commitments.
10 to 12 years. What do you know what you're doing 12 years from now? I don't know.
I'm operating this fund.
Oh, right. Yes.
I've already committed to it. Actually, for 10 years, 10 more years.
You know what I think is interesting, though? I think the micro funds do have a bit more flexibility in that way. Like the micro funds that I've seen have been able to say, okay, we're raising a fund. We'll deploy into 20 companies over 2 years, and then we'll decide. Like if we run out of money, that's fine because, you know, this is a specific purpose of what we're doing this for. So I do see micro funds having a bit more flexibility on that. Would you agree?
I would totally agree. Yeah. And I think it's one of the arguments for running a couple of syndicates and then micro funds before you step up into building a bigger fund, like an MVP fund. You know, first of all, testing out your investment thesis is really important and that you can like build a brand behind what it is that you're looking to deliver. But second of all, you know, it's something where you have flexibility, right? Like if your micro fund is $1 million, if you invested over 1 year or 3 years, depending on your LPs, there's probably a lot more understanding there.
Yeah.
You can do it at the same time as you're still operating. You know, there is an ability for you to have much more flexibility. No one's going to get annoyed if you don't start raising fund two, you know, when you've deployed 750K.
Where's the next vintage?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's not as intense. And so it allows you to kind of play around with it. It's kind of the equivalent of doing your learning checks, you know, deploying smaller check sizes when you first start off. So you can kind of run some water through the pipes and then kind of build from there.
Yeah, 100%. One of the other things that I see or have heard anecdotally, curious to get your thoughts, is that funds tend to, and maybe this is with the bigger funds, but funds tend to deploy into smaller checks into earlier stage, more riskier companies at the start of their deployment period, and then later stage, bigger checks, slightly less risky in our world, companies near the end of that cycle of the fund deployment period. Is that something you see?
Super interesting. I have heard it narrated anecdotally from the fund managers, but I haven't seen it in their behavior. And from what I can see, the emerging fund managers, they're more conservative investing out of like when they're deploying and raising at the same time, because there's almost more scrutiny on investment decisions coming in because they're looking at the portfolio that's coming into that present fund than looking at the fund overall. Whereas when you are a larger fund manager, let's say you're on fund four or fund five, you have sufficient track record that they can look at the stacked funds and make a call across that track record as opposed to what's specifically going into that fund.
See, I think it tracks though, because if you think about like, let's say it's a 4-year deployment period and your fund lifespan is 10 plus 1 plus 1, you know, potentially 12, and you're at the end of that 4-year deployment period, you're going to be looking for companies that then need to be able to possibly exit by within 6 to 7, maybe max 8 years. So it makes sense to invest in slightly later stage companies because you're looking at a shorter exit time horizon. I also think that like anecdotally, I've heard things like, well, you know, at the start of the fund, you're excited. You're like, yes, amazing, super great idea, early stage stuff all the way. And then by the time you're getting to like the 4-year deployment, like you've kind of got 3 to 4 checks left and you're starting to think about the next fund and you're looking at that NAV number and you're thinking, oh, maybe I need a safer bet.
Shoot. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point. I do think you definitely see folks deploying to later stage companies if they've got a multi-stage strategy. But that's more a thoughtful fund construction as opposed to like a trending psychological state over time, right? It's more, yes, absolutely, they're lower risk because they are later stage. But that's because, as exactly as you said, right, you need to make sure that they're paying out or that they have a likelihood of exiting in that time period. You don't want to be in a situation, or ideally don't want to be in a situation, where you're distributing back shares when you're closing the fund at year 12. Yeah. Or being forced into a situation where you're having to kind of liquidate positions that you think have more value to be accrued. It does happen.
Yeah, and at huge discounts usually, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, if you're selling them at secondaries or even kind of selling them as part of a transaction, you know, but forcing the company into a transaction to try to kind of get that liquidity back into the fund, that's not pretty. So yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, right? For folks that are running multi-stage strategies, there is something to be said for that kind of having lots of cash recently raised, kind of ready to be deploying. I can definitely see a psychological state where you're more likely to make more risky investments within your investment strategy when you're first deploying out of that fund. So I guess that is a mental note for the entrepreneurs listening to this. If you happen to be raising something particularly speculative in your stage, try and hit a fund as soon as they've raised, as opposed to on the back half of their deployment. You might be more lucky.
Hey, you just raised. We're super risky. Go.
Go. I wonder for you, I mean, I think you get to see some really interesting micro funds, right? Like an amazing vantage point across the micro fund ecosystem. Do you see these dynamics anecdotally across that group, or do they have less of the pressure of kind of fundraising cycles?
I think they have less pressure. Like micro funds tend to have more flexibility, I think, because people aren't writing, you know, millions of dollars into, like, if, you know, $20 million fund, you've got at least a couple $5 million checks in there, at least a few 1 to 2 millions. Micro funds generally don't have anyone who are writing over like a 500K check, right? So, you know, maybe in terms of what that means for their wealth is still similar, but I think it's just a smaller amount of money. And so people aren't as scrutinous about it, if that's a word. I think micro funds also by nature have to be more thematic and niche. And so that dynamic comes into play more rather than like, oh, let's just find big bets and exciting stuff. It's like, well, we've said that we're going to be investing at the like seed stage, pre-revenue, you know, tiny two-person company in the med tech and health tech and digital health, big AI data space. It's like, well, that's a very specific group of companies, right? And you can do that because if you're only raising $5 million, then like there probably is $5 million worth of investment deals that are great out there. And so if you're sticking to that thesis, then I think the rest of it doesn't matter too much.
It's true. I mean, I think you get a lot more flexibility when you are operating micro fund as someone operating a micro fund versus, you know, taking that step up where you do have quite significant and often much more kind of mature capital allocators.
Sophisticated LPs. Yeah. Once you start getting supers involved, then it's a whole other ballgame.
Yeah, that's a whole other ballgame. That's a whole new kettle of fish for fund managers.
We should get someone on to talk about what it's like to take super money into your fund.
Oh, we should. Fun fact, I've heard this anecdotally, that the supers haven't added any net new fund managers since 2019.
Yeah, I think they've only deployed to the top three.
Yeah. Wild. That means they held back 2020, 2021, 2022. They didn't invest in any net new fund managers coming out of that, which I can kind of make sense. I can kind of understand because, you know, they're risk averse. So they're probably investing in funds 4+. And there's just only a handful of funds that are anywhere near that maturity. And so it sounds like they're investing in like 3 or 4 of the funds that are at that level of maturity.
Yeah. And it's not just maturity, it's size, right? Like ESVCLP funds have a mandate that no one LP can own more than 30%
Mm-hmm.
So you need a fund that is mature enough for them to consider it, but also large enough that when they write their really large checks, because supers have to write really large checks, like they're not getting out of bed for $1 million check here. So that then it asks, they want to write their really large check, but it can't be more than 30% of the fund. So you have to have a big enough fund to be able to accommodate that.
Right. Which is a pretty normal dynamic across a lot of institutionals, right? And the reason they don't want to be more than 30% of the fund is it skews behavior. Well, theoretically, it skews behavior of the fund managers.
Yeah. That's actually a regulation for ESV CLPs.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not, it probably is a desire from the super as well, but there may be a scenario where the super is like, oh, well, actually this is perfectly on theme for us. Like, yeah, we'd love to be your anchor. Cool. We'll give you 30 million. Oh, but you're only raising 50 million? Crap. Okay.
Yeah. It looks like you're raising a $90 million fund.
So I could see a scenario where the super might want to do it, but no, the ESV CLP regulation doesn't allow it.
Yeah, very cool. Actually not that cool for the emerging manager ecosystem.
No.
I don't think we've done a good job. In a lot of larger ecosystems, the super funds have partnered with fund of funds or actually with fund managers and done kind of emerging manager programs where they invest in the fund of funds and the fund of funds invest in the emerging managers and then the super fund gets to invest in the emerging manager that's like top of the grade for that or the managers top of that grade for that fund of funds. But I think our ecosystem is probably too small. It would be tough and too fee sensitive.
I think our ecosystem and the incentives we've placed around fund managers are good, but absolutely due for a refresh.
Absolutely.
They have been designed with a lot of good outcomes in mind, but we have outgrown them pretty quickly. And I think that's a testament to how quickly our ecosystem has grown over the last 10 years, but we have outgrown them. And so they are now holding back some of these dynamics that should be helping our ecosystem progress to being a more mature ecosystem that has some of those things. But I think the current regulations, especially around the ESV CLP, are holding them back. Now, I do know, and I will give government credit, I do know that they are open to suggestions. And I know there are some players, including the big three and some law firms that work for them that are pushing some of these changes to improve the system. But personally, I don't think it's quick enough. And, you know, we can always do better.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
One of the other things I think is really interesting to cover is around the fund size relevance and why it matters. And often what I see is that this like kind of 40 to 50 million cutoff. So when I look at funds, they will usually be somewhere between, they'll be like, well, we're raising between 25 to 50 or 40 to 50 or 10 to 50 or like 10 to 40, right? So like, I feel like there's this invisible line at the $50 million mark, and I'm actually kind of unclear as to why.
Oh, interesting. I would imagine those funds, I'm assuming they're all early stage funds.
Yes. But even like, then the next bucket up is like, oh, okay, well, we're raising 50 to 75 or 60 to 80 or so. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a fund that says we're raising 40 to 75. Like, no, there seems to be this line there.
I would imagine that that line probably represents the realities of fund sizing that you do, right? And kind of similar to for founders when they're thinking about how much do I need to raise for my company, it's a similar dynamic for funds. You're having to think about how many companies can you deploy to? What kind of ownership positions can you buy in those companies, right? You can't deploy a you can, but it's inadvisable to deploy a $3 million check into an idea stage company at a valuation of, say, $30 million. It's done, but it's not a great outcome for the ecosystem. And so there is a certain number of companies that you can support, right? For a super concentrated fund, that's often around the kind of 5 to 7 mark, and you'll see that at growth stage. At the very earliest stage, it's, you know, anywhere between, well, it can be up to 100, but mostly you'll see funds around the kind of 20 to 40 mark doing early stage stuff because it's much more hands-on and there's a certain amount of support you need to give them, but you need diversification. So you're trading off the ability to support them, diversification, how much you can meaningfully invest into those companies at current and predicted market rates. And then lastly, the reality of the venture ecosystem or the venture fund model is that your revenue for your business is 2% of the committed capital to your fund that you take as management fees. So you can imagine you have an incentive to increase funds under management. increase the amount of capital that's in these funds because you're taking 2% of that number as your revenue. But also, if you raise too much, you can't actually meaningfully deploy it into the companies behind the strategy that you're chasing. So I would imagine at a $50 million fund number, that's kind of the upper max for the size of check you can write in, plus the number of companies that you're looking to invest in over that period. Whereas if you're doing growth stage, you may be doing slightly less companies, but you are doing kind of a larger check size. Obviously, for these funds at the 50 million mark, those people are usually doing a primary fund and then an opportunity fund. So primary fund being the company, the fund that you invest in, probably your initial check, maybe your second check after that, sometimes even a third check. And then you have an opportunity fund or like a follow-on fund. So you're maintaining your positions over that period of time.
Yeah, we tend not to see first or even second fund managers doing opportunity funds, though. Typically, we see like you'd start with a core fund, and it's not until like what, fund three or four, that we start to see fund managers going, okay, maybe it makes sense for us to do an opportunity fund now, where that, and for anyone who's following along at home, the definition there is like it's a fund dedicated to just investing in the follow-on rounds of your initial investments, because they've like their stage at which they've gotten to is to later stage for the thesis of the current fund that you're deploying, but they're still great investments. And your fund has pro rata rights, which means that you are essentially foregoing the potential value there because it doesn't fit into the fund thesis that you have, but you have the ability to invest. So a lot of funds will then raise a opportunity fund or a follow-on fund or a continuity fund. I'm sure there's six other names that I'm forgetting.
Those are the main ones, I think. I don't know that I've heard any others out there.
Again, we'll just like, just call it whatever. It's just going to get totally.
Yeah.
That fund is designed to then take advantage of those pro rata opportunities and to double down into those winners, essentially, from the first fund or first or second fund. And often I think the opportunity fund will invest across. So like both, if let's say a fund has a fund one and a fund two, the opportunity fund would not discriminate between the two. You wouldn't do an opportunity fund just for fund one. You would just do one opportunity fund that would invest into companies that are doing well from both of those vintages.
Yeah, the little lulls from the word vintage every single time. It's also a methodology that I'm seeing a lot of people use to kind of benefit from the fact that companies are staying private for longer. So you can imagine, as you said, right, fund one, you don't really raise an opportunity fund because none of the companies you invest in there will be mature enough for the opportunity fund to have anything to invest into. Fund two, that's probably also true, right? Depending on the stage that you start investing, you know, you're usually coming in two rounds after that. So it's 3 to 5 years kind of after your initial investment. But by fund three, you then ideally have a group of investments that you are in a position to follow on behind, that you have fully capped out your follow-on capacity within the existing funds. That it also is a good circumstance, like we were talking about before, in circumstances where companies are private for longer. Some funds are starting to sell their primary positions to their opportunity funds,
thereby generating those returns for their initial fund LPs.
Yep, correct. And often not necessarily, like there is overlap in those LP groups. It's not a one for one, but there is overlap in those LP groups. And they do it as part of a transaction. So there's no kind of untoward valuation dynamics. So they do it as a part of a transaction. They sell part of their position to their opportunity fund, and their opportunity fund holds it for another couple of years before that fund matures.
And theoretically, you could, if you wanted a less risky relative to our asset class. Keep in mind, all of these are extremely risky relative to the broader investment market, but less risky in our world. Then you could only invest in an opportunity fund, and theoretically it would be only investing in those winners and have better access than if you were to invest into a later stage fund, is a thesis.
Right. I think often for the kind of top quartile funds, they actually only allow existing LPs into their opportunity fund for that reason. You know, to try to diminish the number of people that just want to cherry pick, so to speak. Having said that, the majority of your returns come from your first check in your winners. And so sometimes you have underlying funds that perform on a IRR basis to a higher degree than your opportunity fund because you hold it for longer and you come in at higher valuations.
I think though, if you were already invested and you decided not to go into, like, let's say you went into fund one, fund two, and then you were like, hey, I'm not actually down for fund three, but I'll do your opportunity fund. I bet the fund would be like, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think they'd let you in.
Yeah. One thing that's not talked about too much, or actually in our world is probably talked about a lot, but I think isn't covered in the broader like investor LP landscape, and especially for emerging fund managers, is this concept of like, when do you start trying to generate exits, right? Everybody loves to raise a fund. Everybody loves to deploy. But when it actually comes to that, like 7 years down the road, you know, exits don't just materialize. I think when we were talking to Georgie, that was one of the things that she was talking about. Like, they put a lot of focus into like working with the companies to generate those exits. So in terms of our like fund cycles, if you're an emerging fund manager thinking about like, okay, well, I'm, you know, here's my period of raising, here's my period of deploying, here's my period of raising second fund. Where in that cycle do we put the like start working on exits?
Right. Well, for some folks, they say start working on it kind of the year after your deployment period. If you're sitting on a 10 plus two and your deployment period is three, kind of year four is when you should be starting to think about exits. And, you know, the first exits that you will be facilitating will be to acquisitions, right? They're companies where the theses didn't prove out, or the market conditions didn't materialize in the way that you thought they were going to, or there was execution misses, and the outcome being that it's very unlikely the company is going to be able to get to where it needs to get to. And, you know, they might not be able to raise again. So you're starting to see kind of years four to six, you're starting to see the middle of your pack start to need.
Yeah, it's the mediocre ones that like got somewhere, but not all the way there.
Correct. Right, exactly. And so for that group, you're probably starting to work on relationships, starting to work on strategic partnerships and those kinds of things to get them into an acquisition position in that period of time. Kind of for anywhere all the way through to kind of year 12, that's the majority of the work that you end up doing in that period of time. It's actually a side note why it can be so disastrous for a company if the partner that invested in them originally ends up leaving the firm. Then that company, when it comes to exit time, it can be a really bumpy transitioning to a different partner, because the partner might not know the business that well.
And getting their buy-in.
Exactly.
Yeah, because it's a lot of work. I mean, the way Georgie described it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, also a lot of these early M&As, they are tough, right? For the founders.
Yeah, because there's no clear winner. It's not like, hey, you're nailing this, give it to me for 10 billion. It's like, ooh, we might buy it.
Right. And which over the last couple of years, the answer was, we're not buying it.
Yeah.
We're not doing that. And this is the kind of lament that you've been hearing from the Valley for the last couple of years, which is no one's buying. And oh, by the way, you're making it much harder from a M&A regulation perspective for even the middle of our pack to be bought, because you've changed the amount of overview that you are giving these M&A. Now, TBD with Trump in what's going to happen there. But it was a kind of big, big challenge. The middle of the venture portfolio was really tough to start to see exits from that group. So you're getting not a lot of liquidity through. And as a fund manager, if you're getting to fund five and you've got no DPI, which is distributed paid in, i.e. you started to actually pay back that fund, it's really hard for you to stay in business, even by fund three to four.
I'd be surprised if you got to fund five, right? Like fund four, I feel like you'd still be looking at like, even if it was 0.6 returned.
Yeah.
Like I'm surely you're not raising fund four with zero DPI.
Well, I think it depends on how much your TVPI is looking at, especially over the last couple of years, right? There's a lot of people where their DPI is pretty woeful on funds one and sometimes even fund two because of the M&A environment. And I think LPs, that is what's sitting underneath the frustration that a lot of LPs have had, which is they're just not seeing that liquidity back. So I think fund five is like, you're dead in the water.
Similar with angels though, right? Like I look great on paper.
Right.
Not so much in real cash.
Right. Not real cash. So I think when you're thinking about this as a fund manager, or you're planning on being a fund manager, planning liquidity over that period of time can be really useful. There's not a handful of folks that are doing secondaries, but they can be valuable to develop a relationship with as you start to go along that journey, just in case the M&A environment is tough to navigate. Although all predictions are that it's going to be an easier year this year.
Ooh. And if you want a deeper dive into why M&A health matters, I think we also have an episode on that. So jump into that one.
Yeah, us nerding out on liquidity dynamics. You'll love it.
Spoiler alert, it's not all doom and gloom as I was worried it might be.
Right. No, it's great. You get money back. Liquidity, it's the best thing.
Yay. Anything else we need to cover in fund cycles? I feel like this has been a pretty educational session.
Yeah, I think we've covered most of it. I think the last thing to say is it's impossible to get it 100% right. Right. As you are planning on a fund one or maybe planning a fund two or fund three, just try to be diligent and try to plan ahead. Ideally plan it as you are building the fund as opposed to planning it at the end so that you can set yourself up for success at the end. And the number of people that haven't fully planned out their deployment period is problematic.
Yeah. You just see it in a deck, right? Like the fund deck will be like, yeah, 3 years deployment period. I'm like, yeah, okay, great. And then they get to the end or get halfway through and they're like, we're not on track.
Right. Exactly. This has been awesome.
Amazing. Thank you, Maxine.
I'm Lucy.
I'm Kerry, and welcome to Mumbition, the podcast. We chat with incredible women sharing the hilarious, messy, and brilliant truth about mixing motherhood and chasing dreams.
Because building a business while building Lego empires, not always easy, but definitely possible.
So grab a coffee, probably reheated, tune in, and join our community of women who get it.
Mumbition, the podcast for mums daring enough to do both. Unapologetically.
Available now wherever you squeeze podcasts into your day.